On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we are talking about the 50 most likely people to impact the 2025 season. Jake's top 50 list. We dig into all those, some of those people on that list. We have a special guest. It's Ellie Dela Cruz. He's coming on to talk about being the cover star for MLB The Show. And our last segment, we will review some of the storylines that we missed while we were busy previewing all six Major League Baseball divisions. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world traveling north with the club. I'm Jake Mintz. That's George Schusterman. And there's nothing like making that roster, getting on that plane, heading up north with the boys.
I just hope that my team posted a not even really that secret video of me finding out that I am heading north with the team. Because that's the dream. That's what every kid dreams of growing up, is opening social media and seeing that they were being filmed when their manager told them, "You did it, dude."
So I think we have talked about this before. Good morning, everybody. It is secret video season, and I would love for a team to post a video of a player being told that he did not make the roster. Because for every player that makes the roster, there are many that don't, right? And I need an element of suspense, because if I see a video on the internet machine of a player sitting in the manager's office, I already know he's going to be told that he's on the squad. Every once in a while, I need like Pat Murphy telling Caleb Durbin he's going to start the year in Nashville. I need it.
Yeah. Or like some even more uninteresting news, right? It's just like a 5-minute video of the manager just like checking in with him on how he's doing. Like, how do you feel like your infield defense has progressed this? And it's like, you know, sometimes that's how they do like the fake lead in to telling them to make the team. But I want one where there's like no payoff. It's just like, yeah, all right, we're going to keep working on that. It's all right, man. Have a good one. We'll see you later.
Cool. Just post that I love video. It, Jordan.
Oh my gosh. I am still, listen, you know, some percentage of these videos are still very good. I'm still a sucker for the, you know, FaceTime to parents. Like, it's fine. This is all good. It's just that it's become very formulaic to the point where I'm expecting it now, and I'm no longer like that excited to watch those videos. But congratulations FaceTime to everyone the parents, who made the team.
FaceTime the parents is a completely different category to me. I will say the JC Ascara one with Aaron Boone was incredible, because JC Ascara said, "Thanks, brother," to his manager, which I think is just like.
But here's the thing about the FaceTime the parents one, and we're going to get to some, we have a lot going on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast, is I saw the one of Shane Smith, I believe, who was the White Sox Rule 5 pick who made the club. Very cool. Good pitcher. He'll be good. But what happened in his video of the call with the parents is he explicitly said, like, "I'm not going to cry because there's a camera on me." And then it's like, all right, well, this is why we're here. Like, we're here to watch you tear up with your mom on the phone. Like, come on, dude.
Also, we need to unpack the masculinity of that statement a little bit. Like,
I know. Come on, Shane. It's okay. This is it. This is exactly what you should be crying on camera. Anyway, all right.
So crying is underrated. Crying is underrated. And on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we will do just that. Here's the deal. Here's the deal with this episode. It is Monday, March 24th. We just finished our season previews. There's a lot that we missed. Later on in the show, we're going to run through a bunch of it. It'll be Jackie Robinson. It'll be Mookie Betts still being sick. It'll be a bunch of news nuggets. That'll be the third chunk. The second chunk of today's show is going to be literally Ellie Dela Cruz, who we interviewed last week, the MLB The Show cover star, gave us a little bit of his time. That'll be the second chunk. But the first chunk of this episode and the opener is going to be my top 50 list that I do every year. Now, what is this top 50 list? Well, it's not the top 50 best players. If you want that, you can go check out the Foolish 50, courtesy of our friend Foolish Bailey, which I assume is dropping this week. Very excited for that. This list is the top 50 people likely to influence the upcoming season. And the idea of this is trying to peg in advance the storylines that will dominate the season to be. I did this last year. And I did this in 2018. We were at MLB.com. At that time, I did 100 people. And that took way too much time. So I divided by two. And that is how I ended up with 50.
Yes. And this is a fun exercise. And of course, we try and find different ways to preview the season. And I think this is generally a good way to frame a season ahead. Now, of course, this is with all the obvious caveats of you can't predict ball. There are going to be main characters this season that we did not anticipate. But there are some based on the offseason that we've had, based on contractual situations or team dynamics or injury-related returns. There are things that we can kind of look ahead and be like, that is going to be a big deal when this happens, X, Y, Z. And some of the players are obvious right at the very top. But you've broken this into two parts. And so on this opening chat here, this first section of today's podcast, we're going to bounce around. We're not going to count down from 50 to 1. We're not going to spoil the whole list. But we're going to bounce around some of the names that stood out, because I did help you kind of put this list together. We were debating it for much of last week, which players and people had to be on there, because it's also not just 50 players. That's another important part about this. We do want to have some variety in the kinds of characters we're doing. And so it's not just 50 major leaguers. It is, there are some managers, GMs, people beyond that. So where would you like to begin here? Again, we can pick a couple. How do you want to structure this?
I'd like to start with number 42,
Okay.
Which is Munetaka Murakami. Now, this is a slightly odd place to start because it is people who will dictate the MLB season, right? And I have picked a player who is an NPB, but I think he's a perfect example of the type of thing I'm trying to hit on with this piece, which is that there is a scenario where Munetaka Murakami, who is a third baseman for the Yakult Swallows in NPB, a player who in 2022 hit 56 home runs and broke the single season record for home runs for a Japanese-born player at the age of 22. He is now 25. If he goes out there and hits 49 home runs this season and enters, he's going to be posted this winter. Like, that is 100% happening. It is agreed upon with him and his team. He's coming over. If he has a monster season, we're going to, down the stretch here, it's going to pick up some steam and you're going to get photoshops of him in a Yankee jersey. Like, that is absolutely going to happen. And so what I'm trying to do with that is put that on your radar ahead of time.
Yeah. And I think he's a really good one. Of course, it's a good one to fold in coming off the Tokyo series. And it's also a big distinction between someone like Yamamoto and someone like Sasaki. If you remember, obviously a lot of people, everyone in baseball knew who Roki Sasaki was, but the casual fan, it wasn't really as obvious last year because we weren't sure if he was actually going to get posted. Whereas Yamamoto, we knew his last year in Japan, it was like, all right, we're building up to this big free agency. There's a possibility that right. We're doing the same thing with Murakami, where, as you mentioned, if he's leading the league in home runs again, the last couple seasons, he hasn't been as good. He's been still a prodigious slugger, but striking out a bunch. So it's possible he doesn't totally cash in. But as someone who's still just 25, one of the most talented hitters in Japan, it's just part of the theme of Japanese baseball becoming one of the most important parts of our everyday major league experience. And he is kind of the next one. And as a hitter in particular, who could be in some ways one of the more hyped ones we've seen. We've had some good hitters come over, like Suzuki, of course, recently. But this guy, because of what he did, which was historic, there's a chance we're talking about him a ton as the winter approaches.
Let's hop back to number 50. The last name on this list, which is Chandler Simpson. So Chandler Simpson is the fastest person in baseball. He is not going to start the year with the Rays. He's an outfield prospect. At some point this year, he will debut and he will conjure up a base running highlight reel that you cannot fathom, that you cannot imagine. He brings a very different style of baseball that we used to see all the time, where he's just trying to touch it with the bat and let himself scoot down to first base. I cannot wait to see it. I feel so confident that it's going to be a thing. And that is, I guess, the whole thing of this list, right? It's like, what is going to be a thing this year?
Yeah. And I think the Chandler Simpson one is a funny one after last year, where you use the number 50 spot to put Victor Scott, who also stole nearly 100 bases in the minors. And it was like, okay, this is going to be the guy that's blowing everyone away with his speed. the difference in the two and why Chandler Simpson, there's more optimism that he's going to be able to maximize this otherworldly ability, is he puts the bat on the ball in a way.
And
that,
he's faster. And he is faster.
He's faster. I mean, Victor Scott obviously is also one of the 10 fastest players on the planet. But Chandler Simpson is a different level. And the fact that he doesn't strike out ever and swings all the time is different. Whereas Victor Scott, obviously his hit tool was exposed last year to where he was not relevant. However, it is worth saying that Victor Scott did win the opening day center fielder job for the Cardinals this season. And perhaps he will also make some level of effort if he is getting enough playing time to lead Major League Baseball in stolen bases.
Let's go to number 35. Jed Hoyer, the president of baseball operations for the Chicago Cubs. It feels like there is a spot for this style of person every year on my list, and it is the executive with heat on the chair. The Chicago Cubs have not won a playoff game since 2017. It is the fourth longest drought in MLB. The only teams with longer droughts are
the Orioles.
Yep.
The Angels.
Yep.
The Pirates. And yep. Who's the one more?
That's it. Oh, there's the four.
Oh, four. Okay.
That's it.
There you go.
That's not good when you're the Cubs and you have tons of money to spend. And Jed Hoyer, who took over operational control of the Cubs in November of 2020, he was the one who oversaw the teardown, right? In 2021, they trade away Rizzo and Bryant and Baez, and they embark on this rebuild. And even though the team was competent last year, that's not the bar here. That's not the threshold. Like, the Cubs need to be in the playoffs in this era of sports. And with Hoyer's contract up at the end of the year, You started to see a little bit of that urgency over the winter when he went and traded for Kyle Tucker, mortgaging the future a little bit for the present.
And perhaps mortgaging the present for the present, as Cam Smith might be the opening day right fielder. Sorry, anyway, continue. Cam Smith also on this list.
Also on this list. Jed Hoyer is just a fascinating character because he has to act. Not desperately, but urgently.
That's the thing. And that is what's most interesting, is we look at through the lens of how they acted this past offseason. Now, he was also limited in, clearly, the Cubs were only willing to spend a certain amount of money. You know, they tried to get Tanner Scott. They get outbid. They don't have any interest in pursuing Corbin Burns or some of the other guys at the top of the market.
They did a fake Bregman pursuit.
Sure. That's one way to put it. It doesn't seem like they finished second on Bregman, but they were involved to some degree. But to your point, if we're projecting to the forward into the season, it's, does he make a Kyle Tucker style trade in July or some version of that? You know, if they are close enough, do they continue? They still have a bunch of prospects they could trade. Is there more urgency expressed if they are hopefully in the mix?
And that brings us to our next chunk of players at 32, 33, and 34. I have this labeled as needle-moving trade chips.
Sure.
And that is Sandy Alcantara, Luis Robert Jr., and Nolan Arenado. Something that I am very interested in about this season is that there are only two teams entering this season with zero legitimate plans of competing. That is a number that is usually much higher than that. That there are teams that are maybe not tanking, but they are not showing up. The general manager is not showing up expecting to win a World Series or make the playoffs. And the Marlins and the White Sox are really the only two teams in the middle of a legitimate, disastrous, ugly teardown. And that makes their top trade chips, Sandy Alcantara.
A purposeful teardown, right? We know the Rockies. Purposeful. We know the Rockies are doing their own thing and they're going to lose 100 games. But this is the plan. We're trying to lose.
Sure. And like the Angels are like the Rockies, where it's like they think that they're trying, and I guess the way to say it is the White Sox and the Marlins are willing to trade away good players in the offseason for prospects. Now, the Cardinals kind of fit into this too, because they might be at that point. I think they're the team most likely to pull the plug and start trading away pieces at the deadline, and that's where Nolan Arenado comes in, a player who we thought would be traded already. He has not been. I'm more compelled by Alcantara and Robert just because of how potentially game-changing they can be when they're going right. Like, Alcantara won the Cy Young in 2022, was compromised and probably hurt and still pretty good in 2023, got TJ, missed all of 2024. He's starting on opening day for the Marlins. If he has a good 2 months, he will be on a plane to another city. I feel very confident about that. Robert is a lot more of a volatile piece just because he's had so many injuries, so many ups and downs. But his 2023 was superb from a production standpoint, and every single team could use Luis Robert Jr.
Yeah. The one other name, I'll let you choose since it's your list. The one other group that I want to talk about in the back half of the list, and then we can skip ahead to maybe a couple in the top half. Do you want to talk about Dominguez or the Jacksons? Because I'm super compelled by both. Okay.
After you.
Let's talk about Jason Dominguez. So we debated, you know, obviously when you're doing a list of 50 and it's like, okay, who are the teams we're going to be talking about the most? You know that the Dodgers and Yankees, you could argue for a lot of players that are going to be in the news regarding this season.
Correct.
And there are a few Yankees you could choose, some of whom have certainly elevated even since the beginning of spring training as injuries have happened and Gerrit Cole's gone down. And you could look at the pitchers and Stroman and all these things. And Fried, oh man, a $200 million pitcher. To me,
Jazz, Austin Wells.
Sure, like Volpe, of course, right. We talk about the Yankees all the time. However, it's not that Jason Dominguez is the maybe most important player on the Yankees this season, but to me, this is the time. We have been talking about this guy essentially since before he signed, because this is one of the rare, international prospects that kind of breaks through into the mainstream. A lot of that is because he got a record deal from the Yankees. There are other players that have signed for $4 or $5 million that nobody cares about because they're not the Yankees. But because he had all this mystique around him, and what's so interesting about Dominguez is that all along the way, because he's also been injured kind of so often at certain points, he still hasn't really played that much baseball. And yet he's still only 22. But now is the time. We have finally made it to the point where they are like, Jason Dominguez is on the Yankees. And in some ways it feels like it's taken forever. And in some ways it feels like he is still, 15 years old and has barely accomplished anything. He is the rare player that has somehow managed to perfectly thread the needle between like underperforming and kind of doing exactly what he's supposed to do. Like, he was hitting pretty damn well in AAA last year as still one of the youngest players in AAA, but he's still injured and the team clearly did not trust him at all in the playoffs or down the stretch. They were not ready to play him. But now, partially because they don't really have any other options, they're like, yes, Jason Dominguez, he is our guy in some capacity. And it still feels like maybe we're too early to be expecting too much from him. But at the same time, if he's able to become an above average hitter on the Yankees at age 22, as he was supposed to be when he was 13 or whatever, when unfortunately we were probably hearing about him first and his baseball cards were going for outrageous sums of money, it's cool to finally be here and to finally find out what is this actually going to look like.
And that's what I'm most compelled by, is just knowing and seeing it and watching it over a full season. I mean, he debuts as a 20-year-old in 2023. Gets hurt, has injuries last year again, plays a little bit. Now it's time. Now it's go time for a player who was once compared literally to Mike Trout. All right, let's do the Jacksons. And that's the Jackson 4 of Merrill, Churio, Jobe, Holiday. Merrill, Churio, Holiday, all rookies on this list last year, all had very different rookie seasons. Holiday, bad the whole time for the Orioles. Churio, treading water in the first half. Catches fire down the stretch, one of the better hitters in baseball the second half. Merrill, basically good the whole time. Like, MVP votes, receiver,
All-star.
Rookie of the year runner-up,
yep.
All-star, like, playing center field for the first time in his life. Oh my God, what a thing. And now we can add Jobe into that mix. Jobe, unlike this other three, these other three, is a pitcher. Okay, but he has made the team. He will be the number 5 starter for the Tigers this year. He will be appointment viewing whenever he takes the mound. He is also named Jackson. He is the same age as these other 4 guys, more or less. And I just think it's so funny that they're all named Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a name we had seen a ton of throughout the major league history before this group, but to have all four of them be very relevant, important young players at this stage. And also, again, we've kind of made this point already, but speaking of you can't predict ball, who knows how this is going to go for these four guys this year, right? We were all like, okay, Holiday. I mean, that's the one we feel like we know how this is going to go, as opposed to Churio, who is the youngest of the group, and Merrill, who is like trying to learn center field and had barely played in the minor leagues. Like, Merrill and Churio felt like the less sure things than the son of the former All-Star and all these things, right? And Holiday turned out to be the one that struggled. Obviously, Job is a pitcher. There's a lot of reasons you can't predict what's going to happen with him, but it is fun to fold him in, and he is still rookie eligible, so he will be pushing for some hardware this year.
Churio is the one I'm most compelled by. I think he will finish with the best season. Hmm. I think he will receive MVP votes. I think we will look up in the middle of the year, and he'll be at the All-Star game and one of the better players in the sport. I am irrationally high on Jackson Churio, and I think you should be too.
That's not one you can say irrationally high. That's not. It's rational.
Yeah.
He just turned 21. I think he's like a full year or 2 years younger than some of the other guys. He is still the only major leaguer born in 2004. The first one, and still the only one.
Very
so
cool.
That makes us all feel great. And he's a good one. He's a fun one.
I want to do the Astros next, and that is Jose Altuve and Cam Smith, who are at 23 and 22. And I am so compelled by this particular duo, neither of whom really has a defensive home that they are good at. Like, they're both. I know that Altuve is going to play left and Cam Smith might play right, but neither of them are good at it. And yet they are so integral to the 2025 Astros keeping this thing going. Altuve, who is inching through his 30s, is moving to left, and his offensive game took a step back last year, and he's going to keep trying to rage against the dying of the light. Whereas Cam Smith, who they acquired 3 months ago with dreams of 2027, just showed up to camp and looks relatively ready and will be a meaningful member of this Astros team this season. This duo fascinates me.
Yeah, it's also just fun, them both learning a new position. I don't think we have any idea how good of a defender Cam Smith is in right, in the same way we don't really for Altuve, although because Altuve's 35 and not 22, it's certainly harder to be optimistic. But
yeah,
you have Cam Smith, who has essentially only been a third baseman in college. I think he played like a couple games in the outfield in the Cape Cod League. But other than that, he's been a third baseman. And now, like 2 weeks ago, they were like, all right, well, we need to get you to the big league sooner rather than later. And so you're going to start playing right field. The physical spectrum of both of them, I know he's not quite as tall as Aaron Judge, but still Cam Smith, who, you know, is built like Superman, and having him and Altuve kind of in the corners is pretty great. But yeah, I mean, both of them is being, because Altuve needs to continue to hit, as we said in the AL West preview, for the Astros to feel good. But Cam Smith, if he is actually going to show up and be this good, will help mitigate some of the other losses in the lineup.
Pick a group here, and then I'll do a couple at the top.
Yeah, we'll I guess if we're looking more at the top, I mean, Roki is an interesting one. I think the Sasaki one is one where it's like, because we spent so much of the winter talking about him, we just saw him in Tokyo, and we're going to keep talking about him. My struggle with the Roki one is it's like, he's so important and so interesting and won't really likely impact much of whether the Dodgers are good or not for most of the season. And so you kind of want to balance the expectations and the fact that the team itself has been like, this is a work in progress. I mean, in some ways that makes him more compelling, but it's a little bit of a different situation than a guy like Yamamoto a year ago, where he was expected to come in and like immediately contribute to the Dodgers finally winning World Series again. And guess what? He did. that happened, and it was really cool. And now he's one of the best pitchers in the world. So I think with Sasaki though, every single start is going to be a, what is this one going to look like? Is he going to improve every time? As that workload builds up and he gets closer to an amount of innings that he hasn't thrown in his career, is that compelling? So in that sense, I think whereas Yamamoto, we kind of just like, oh yeah, like that's what Yamamoto is. We kind of know what that looks like. Sasaki, I think, is just going to be much more variance, and that's going to make it more compelling.
I have Strider and Acuna right above Sasaki grouped together. I mean, injured Braves coming back, they could combine for 13 war.
I mean, that feels aggressive based on them, how much they're going to play. If Acuna is not going to play until May and isn't going to run. And
okay, let's say 11.
Okay, sure. That still seems pretty bullish. But yes, we get it. We know.
It could be 11 or 3, right?
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. I mean, Acuna, I'm more interested in Acuna, I think, than Strider. Strider, we've already seen. He's back. He pretty much looks like Strider. Acuna, it's more about what is this? What version of are we going to get? And that's influenced by how he looked right before he got injured again. That's influenced by them saying, like, okay, dude, like, probably shouldn't be running every single time with your multiple ACL tears. That's influenced by, is he a terrible defender? Is he a good defender? Like, there's a lot of things that could go into that.
And it's influenced by what happened last time he tore an ACL, where it pretty much took him a full season to get back to being Ronald Acuna Jr. And so if he shows up this year and is solid, it's not alarm bells. Will it be an easier return because he's done the ACL rehab before and he knows what to expect? I don't know. I think it is a fascinating mystery box that could swing the entire National League.
Yeah.
Like, it is a huge deal, because if they have legit Strider and legit Acuna entering October, they could totally beat the Dodgers. Right. And if they don't, it's hard to imagine they can. Let's go to the tippity top. And let's talk about Vlad Jr., who I think you and I don't disagree somewhat about Vlad, but I think we maybe have differing opinions on how important he is. I think you view him in the upper echelon, the tippity top of stardom, and his contract status is worthy of, is close to where Soto was at last year. I'm a little bit less drawn to it.
Well, he's not on the Yankees, so I understand that
he's not on the Yankees. Yes.
It's not.
I still have him at number two.
Sure,
I still have him at number two, in part because I think you made a really strong argument about it. Why don't you walk people through why you see Vlad as such a significant figure for this upcoming season?
Yeah, I mean, I think that guys in their contract years is always an easy pick, and we have a couple of those on here. But the Vlad story and how it has continued to evolve. Which I mean, again, we could talk about Mark Shapiro going out publicly and being like, yep, we're going to extend him. I feel good about that at this stage, way past the deadline. And Vlad saying, I don't want to talk about it, and then continuing to talk about it nonstop for the last month. All of those things are relevant. But when you combine that with the Blue Jays as a team that we will also be talking about because of their situation that is highly related to Vlad, but not exclusively related to Vlad. It's just the kind of thing that if they are heading in the wrong direction, which, as we talked about in the AL East preview, we are, you know, kind of worried that it might be. He is just going to be the one that people are trying to get out of there, whether it's fair to Blue Jays fans or not. Now, based on Mark Shapiro's comments, maybe he doesn't even really care. And he's just like, no, Vlad's going to be a Blue Jay. And he's just living in that fantasy world or a reality world, because maybe you could look at that and be like, well, he wouldn't say that if he didn't think he was going to get this done. But I also just think that Vlad is such an important player. I mean, he has been also as the legacy guy who has become pretty much lived up to the hype, which is a lot of hype. And he has become one of the best hitters on the planet. I think he is someone that casual fans know and care about. And if he is not going to be on the Blue Jays, that would be a huge deal for people beyond Toronto as well.
Does Vlad play a playoff game this year?
No. I think he's going to play the whole year with the Blue Jays. And then I don't know what's going to happen after that. So.
Okay. Cool. The one player on this list who I wanted higher and Jordan bullied me into dropping was Skeens, who I have at six. Even now, as I look at this list, I just want to move him up. I think he is so significant. I think his crossover appeal is enormous. I think that he is the only starting pitcher we have right now who is appointment viewing for a casual fan. Like, you, Jordan, are turning on the television for Jackson Job. But our friends from high school are not. Some of them may do that for Skeens, or are more likely to do that for Skeens. And in my opinion, having a pitcher, a character like that, who breaks the season up into fifths, where you can schedule your attention around his performance, is the best. It's the best. We had this with Jose Fernandez, with R.A. Dickey, Matt Harvey, Jacob deGrom at certain points. Having that peg in the week of, oh, Thursday night, I got a, Skeens is throwing, like, I want to sit down and watch that. I think that's a big, big deal. Why were you, I mean, saying you're low on Skeens as a storyline is silly, because he's still, you were like, I would have him in the top 10. But I'm just curious, like, why do you think we differ on that?
Yeah, I think that what you're describing was true last year when he finally came up and threw the All-Star game, when him starting the All-Star game as a rookie is unbelievable. I still think that by the end of the year, it was already fading to the point where I was like, well, he said the Pirates suck. They're not relevant. Like, okay, great. Skeen's going to go out and he's going to pitch well, and the Pirates are maybe going to win, maybe not. And it doesn't matter because they're not going to the postseason. And so if the Pirates can surprise and the Pirates are like within striking distance of the wild card in the second half, yeah, yeah. Because then it's going to be like, well, if Skeens is pitching, like, this is their chance to win. Like, this is their chance to move forward. Like, Skeens is trying to will this franchise back to the postseason. That could happen. But there's a long way to go to get to that point. And I think that while he is a singular star as a starting pitcher, and I absolutely think he belongs up here, I just think he is going to be burdened by his team in a way that most people will eventually just be like, that's unfortunate. Like, I, you know, that's really cool. Like, he's awesome. And if he, I think... And the other way that he could prove you right is if he has like one of the greatest seasons we've ever seen, which you could say, yeah, well, he's capable of that because look what he did as a rookie. But I still think that the bar for that is pretty high. Like, his ERA would need to be like 0.6 on like July 5th. And that's really hard to do. So maybe he does because he has that talent. Otherwise, I just think it's hard for someone on a team we don't think is going to be very good to really be that relevant.
Spoken like a man who watched quite a few Felix Hernandez starts.
Amen, brother.
Shohei Ohtani is obviously number one. Okay, let's take a quick break.
Yes.
And we will chat with the gentleman who is at number 11.
Yes.
On this list.
Yeah, so
Ellie De La Cruz.
This is a little chat with Ellie. Obviously, part of the MLB The Show cover with Gunnar Henderson, with Paul Skeens, who we just talked about. So Ellie doing, of course, a lot of promo for MLB The Show, but it was very cool to get to talk to him and talk to him about some of his favorite moments from his young big league career so far, because he is a highlight factory. He is almost more than, I mean, it's a short list of players who are producing more highlights than Ellie De La Cruz. So that was kind of how we framed our conversation.
Nobody is producing more different types of highlights than Ellie De La Cruz, right? He is producing base running, hitting, and fielding. No one else is doing it at the same clip, at the same level that he is in that way. I also want to commend Ellie for doing all of this stuff in English. It's really unbelievable and impressive and deserves a lot of kudos.
Yes, I did want to mention that. Having been there at the beginning of his major league career, I was there when he debuted, and even then he was already really trying when he was, 21, 22. He's already come so far with that. Like, he is confident with it. He is doing interviews in English. Of course, there are some hiccups along the way, but it's incredible. And it's also part of why that's also part of why you want to have him on the cover. That's why you want to have him as one of the face of baseball. Like, it's not necessary, but the fact that he's willing to do it is awesome. And clearly, I think going to help him in a lot of ways. So we love Ellie, and it was really cool to get to chat with him. So hopefully you enjoy this brief conversation with Ellie De La Cruz. And then we'll be back after our convo with Ellie to talk a little bit about what we missed over the last 2 weeks. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecast. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by one of the cover stars of MLB The Show 2025, Ellie De La Cruz of the Cincinnati Reds. Ellie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
So, Ellie, being on the cover alongside Paul Skeens and Gunnar Henderson, what is it like? What is it like to play with yourself in a video game? How has that experience been?
It's really good. Really exciting. And I'm really grateful for that. really excited to share the cover with those guys, those superstars, and I'm so happy.
So when you play the game as you, is that cool? Is that weird? Is that fun?
It's cool. It's fun. It's really fun to play with yourself in the game.
Is that something when you were younger that you, if you played MLB The Show when you were younger, did you say, I want to be in this game someday?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a little kid, I was like thinking about it. Like, I want to play with myself in the show.
And now that dream has come true. Not only do you get to, you know, use your character, you are on the cover, which is pretty cool. So, Ellie, as the baseball world has gotten to know you, I think the first thing, or one of the first things people think about is your speed. I remember when you said, I'm the fastest man in the world, but that wasn't necessarily always the case. So when did you know, okay, I'm fast. I might be the fastest man in the world.
I've always been fast. Like, since I was a little kid, I was fast. But I realized I was so fast in 2020. I worked a lot in the offseason and COVID and the pandemic. And I realized I was like so fast.
What's the most fun part about being fast? I am not fast. He is not fast. We don't know what that's like. What do you enjoy about it?
I enjoy when I'm playing the game, like running around the bases, because it gives you like electricity. Like, you having so much fun when you like running fast.
Because the thing is, like, when you can do things other people cannot do, right? When you're playing and you're that fast, like, do you see the game fast too?
We try to slow the game. Like, we don't want to see the game fast.
So the legs are fast and the brain moves slow. That's good to know. That's good to know.
What are your goals in terms of stolen bases this year? Again, I think people would be surprised. Early in your career, I think you only stole 3 bases in your first professional season in the Dominican Summer League, 67 last year, leading Major League Baseball. How high do you think that number can get as you look forward?
I don't really know. I'm not looking forward. I just want to be healthy and be able to play every day. I believe something's going to happen. Something good. If we play every day, those things are going to show up.
Do you like stealing second or third more?
Both. I like both.
Do you have a favorite?
Stealing third is more fun.
Third's more fun? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite stolen base or base running play that you've had in the major leagues that stands out?
Yeah, when I stole home. And when I hit the inside of the park.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is it like stealing home? Because that is very different than stealing second and stealing third. What are the feelings when you're trying to steal home?
It's like exciting. When you see the opportunity and you take it, like when you almost make it, you like you say, like, "Damn, I'm about to make it," and it's so fun. It's a lot of fun.
So when you hit the inside the park home run against the Brewers, when did you realize going around the bases that you could score?
As soon as he died for that ball and I see that ball going back, I say, I'm not going to stop until I get home.
Okay.
that's a good answer. So let's talk about your defense. You had a lot of success at shortstop last year. Is there one defensive play that you have made in the major leagues that stands out as your favorite?
Yeah, there's a lot, but there's one that I like. I did in Colorado. It was like Derek Jeter play. I like that one a lot because he is my favorite player, and I did it just like him.
It was like the jump throw.
Yeah,
is that your favorite kind of play to make as a shortstop, or are there other plays that you like to play defensively?
That definitely is one of my favorite, but I like, now I'm focused on the routine plays. That's what I want to make, like all the routine plays.
Right.
Let's go back to your offense and let's talk about some home runs. You've had a bunch in your first couple years of your career. Yeah, we mentioned the inside the Parker, but you've also hit many over the fence. So what's been your favorite home run? Is there one home run that stands out as your favorite so far as a big leaguer?
I hit one in Minnesota in Grand Slam. That was my first one. I liked that one. I have a lot, but like if I start telling you right now, we're not gonna end.
With too many. What do you remember about your first career home run, the one against the Dodgers? What stands out about that when you think back about that home run?
When I think about that home run, I just think about how was the crowd. It was electric. Like, it was so many people there, and I remember talking to one of my friends, and I said, here, you just got to touch it the day before. You just got to touch it in the air, and it's going to be gone. And the first AB, the next day, I did it just like that.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think what your friend is talking about, of course, in Cincinnati, a lot of home runs there. But the one you hit that day almost left the stadium.
Yeah, are we going to go in the river?
Yeah. Do we think we can get over those seats in right field at some point?
I don't know. Let's see what the future brings.
Yeah. Yeah. I like your chances. So looking ahead to this season, this is our last question for you, Ellie. You have a new manager, Terry Francona. He's said a lot of very nice things about you so far as your new skipper. A lot of reasons to be excited about him and the Reds this year. What is your favorite thing about Terry Francona now that you've gotten to know him for a few months?
I like Tito a lot. My favorite thing about him is he's like straight. If he gotta tell you something, it doesn't matter if you don't like, he's gonna tell you. Like, he's straight, and even spring training in the season is gonna be the same. And he likes to communicate with the players and have a good communication.
Awesome. Well, Ellie, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations again on being on the cover of the show. We hope to see you hit a ball into the water. We hope to see you steal 100 bases. We hope to see, 100 home runs.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Stay healthy. Good luck. And thank you so much for joining us, Ellie. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Because we were doing our season previews the last 2 weeks, we missed a lot. There are kind of two categories of things we missed. I would say there's like storylines and then there's news nuggets. We're going to take all those nuggets and we're going to put them in our back pocket for a second. But let's just talk about some of the main stories we missed. I think one of the bigger ones was what happened with Jackie Robinson and the Defense Department's website, which is, imagine explaining that sentence to Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, this was a story, of course, that was highlighted and brought to our attention by Jeff Passan of ESPN, which is basically that the Department of Defense, the official website, which has certainly changed since the administration has changed, had a story highlighting Jackie Robinson's military service that was deleted. And when Jeff Passan was like, hey, why are we erasing stories about Jackie Robinson on official government websites celebrating one of the most important people in American history? What's up with that? The press secretary of the Pentagon was like, yeah, Jackie Robinson is not important through the prism of race.
So obviously,
our administration is on a crusade to basically
on a heater.
Essentially eliminate any sort of concept of diversity on any sort of official government apparatus. And that is troubling for many reasons that are both horribly offensive and troubling and depressing and discouraging. And then also in this case, patently ridiculous.
And so this story, of course, kind of grew to a point where Jeff Passan rightly, he got a comment from the secretary, you know, the press secretary, citing the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, being like, DI is dead, diversity doesn't matter, so Jackie Robinson doesn't matter. But then, thankfully, to some degree, this story was restored with them being like, oh, no, yeah, you're right, Jackie Robinson's pretty important. This is a horribly depressing sequence of events that is so embarrassing on so many levels that I don't even really know how to talk about it without getting very angry, but it is a story that made waves and is worth taking a moment to acknowledge again, even a week later.
The Department of Defense claimed that it mistakenly removed this. Now, I am not exactly willing to give the current setup the benefit of the doubt is where I'm at. But the idea that in the wake of it, even if it was a mistake, the argument that Jackie Robinson should not be viewed through the prism of race is comical. Like, it's that's the whole, not the whole thing, but that's the thing here. Okay, we're not like, he's not famous. Like, Jeff Kent is not Jackie Robinson. It's not like he's around. Jackie Robinson, we don't have Jackie Robinson Day because he was a good player. I mean, that was important as part of the story, but it's because of what he did by breaking the color barrier, right? And to try and celebrate him without that is absurd. And in the context of his military service, where he was court-martialed for refusing to move to the back of the bus, like, he is a story. He is a person who his legacy should be bipartisan and should, like, people have also whitewashed that legacy so much. The idea that Jackie Robinson is controversial, that's also laughable, right? And this whole thing was just so disheartening and, to a certain extent, unsurprising, and to a certain extent, I didn't even want to give it oxygen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's
because
that
it's like,
that was how I felt at the time, is it just felt so ridiculous. And yet, I think that is the important thing to take away here, though, before we move on to things that do not make us furious to talk about, is it is an unfortunately brutal reminder that, like, why this is important to continue to talk about every year in the first place. You know,
right.
Like, the fact that there are people apparently still actively trying to erase as you know, as Jeff very rightly said in one of his tweets about this, like, history is all we have. So if we're going to try and get rid of these parts of history really aggressively, we're in a really, really bad place. You would think, as you mentioned, that this would be one player and person and story that would be fairly bipartisan, obvious, like a pretty neutral good in this in the context of society. And yet, if we're going out of our way to be like, no, actually, he was only important because he was in the military. Well, guess what? That story isn't particularly inspiring either when you consider what Jackie Robinson had to deal with as a member of the military. So anyway, as you can tell, not the most fun topic, but we did want to acknowledge it because it was it certainly was a story. So shout out to Jeff, I guess, for highlighting
and
this and you know, getting this noticed.
I'm curious how this impacts Jackie Robinson Day at all, if which is coming up.
That's true.
In a couple of weeks already. Like,
yeah.
What's the fallout here? We'll see. Other nuggets, the TV deal stuff.
Yes, this is a brief thing that we wanted to acknowledge because this has been a storyline for the whole offseason, but now I think is a good time to at least point out what has occurred. One of the main things that has angered baseball fans for several years now, since baseball has become more digital and we have MLB TV, is the concept of blackouts. And the very simple way to put it is that if you have MLB TV, in pretty much most cases, you cannot watch the team that is near you if you are living near the home team, because the way MLB TV works is you can't watch the team that is near you because that is the rights of the cable company that broadcasts the games. And so because of that, it has been very difficult for people in their own markets to digitally access their own favorite baseball team through MLB TV without having expensive cable. Last year, there were only 13 teams that allowed for a streaming option for fans in market that they could buy separate from the actual cable company. After this offseason, we have now more than doubled that number to where 27 of the 30 teams because of a series of complicated, not interesting television negotiations involving different media companies going bankrupt and changing hands and all these things. 27 of the 30 teams now, fans in market can buy a streaming package unrelated to cable to watch their baseball team. The prices are different. You know, the Dodgers are obviously a lot more expensive than, you know, the Pirates and XYZ within market. That's all fine. The point is there is access for fans to watch their favorite team in ways that people watch baseball in 2025. That is good. However, the hell we got there, that is a good, good, good thing.
MLB has received a lot of criticism over the years for the blackout situations, Commissioner Rob Manfred specifically. And if you listen to us, you know, like, we're not out here standing Rob Manfred. I will say, the league was never like amped about blackouts. That was never their goal. The league does want people to be able to watch the product. The current leadership at the league, I think, was kind of grandfathered into this system and hamstrung by the realities of it. And over time, we have seen their desire and willingness to break down and remove the blackouts. Like, that's the goal. That has been the goal, and they have succeeded. Now, it took longer than I think people would like, and maybe there is some criticism worth throwing around there, but we've ended up in a place where there are now just three teams where you're blacked out in market, and that's hilariously the Astros, Nationals, and the Orioles. The Nationals, who presumably next year after getting out of the Masson deal with the Orioles, will be able to go DTC, direct to consumer. So, I mean, this is just a good thing.
And and the last thing I'll say is just the fact that this has changed this much in one offseason should just speak to how fast all of this is moving. There's a lot of other complicated factors involving it, but I do think that it is a relevant thing to finally acknowledge now that we have gotten to this point in the offseason. So there you go.
Absolutely. Last thing before we do a little news nugget draft, new City Connects. We already have two that have dropped, the Nationals and the Astros. We have six more teams releasing them this season: Diamondbacks, Red Sox, White Sox, Rockies, Marlins, Giants. My understanding is that the jerseys work on like a 4 or 5 year cycle, where part of the contract stipulation with Nike is that they have to do new ones, which is somewhat unfortunate for teams that nailed the first one, like the Nats and the Cherry Blossoms, or the Marlins and the Sugar Kings ones. We love the Rockies ones. So I wish those were staying in the rotation. But again, at the end of the day, the goal is to sell schmatas, and Nike will continue to do that. That being said, I think the new Astros and Nats ones both rule.
Yeah, we're into these. The Astros, of course, previously rolling with the Space City theme, with one of the more unique fonts I think we've seen in City Connect history. But now they're going with the Stros. The Space City is a little bit more muted. I think it's just part of the patch, and they're leaning into sort of the older school color scheme, and it's sharp. The hat is a little, I don't know about the hat. The hat's
it's a little big.
The hat's a little, the A is a little big, and it's not as obvious that it is an Astros thing. But other than that, I think these are good. And then the Nationals going with the blue DC grid is pretty sharp as well.
I loved the memes that I saw of, I think you should leave, expensive shirts, Dan flashes, people zooming into the pattern on the Nats. That's good stuff. I love that the Astros uniform has a JFK quote on it from his speech at Rice University. Mm-hmm. Why does Rice play Texas? Do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Hilarious to me. These are good. They look good. That's all I really care about.
That's that JFK quote is talking about the Astros offseason. Like, listen, we're going to trade Kyle Tucker. We're going to play Jose Altuve at left. We're going to let Alex Bregman go. Not because it's easy. Cam Smith is like, you know, he's part of this too. He's gonna
Why
make,
does Cam, he, Cam Smith Smith's play Texas?
Make, by the way, Cam Smith's gonna make any jersey look good. Let's be honest. Cam Smith is what they look like. All right.
You could put him in a plastic bag and I'd draft him first.
We will continue to react to City Connects as they I don't know when the next one's coming out, but anyway.
Here are the rules of the upcoming exercise, Jordan. We will each draft. Let's do five news nuggets from the last 2 weeks. You have a maximum of 45 seconds to talk about your nugget. Yes. I have a clock in front of me.
This is an alternative turbo mode segment because we have too much to talk about. We're not going to straight turbo mode it. Anything, if it's an extension, it's a signing, it's an injury, it's a roster decision, all of that is on the board. We will each draft five. We will take turns. You can have the first pick.
I get the first pick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I will take the Braves. Everything the Braves have done, that includes signing Craig Kimbrell, Alex Verdugo, Jesse Chavez, James McCann, Hector Neris. Okay? That is a quintet of veterans that have just showed up on the Braves in the last few weeks. I'm most fascinated by Verdugo because there's not a clear place for him to be playing. Does he end up getting traded? He's going to start in the minor leagues, I guess, to try and work his way back up. Kimbrell is also hilarious because considering how horrible he was last year, this is like the only place where the fan base is amped to have Craig Kimbrell around. Hopefully he can turn the clock back one more time.
And then we also just have to mention this trade that they just made, trading Ian Anderson to the Angels for Jose Suarez, the latest high-end Braves pitching prospect or draft pick to be shipped out. As soon as you are no longer good enough for them, they say adios. But Ian Anderson, what a run. And I'm actually going to use Ian Anderson, who accomplished a lot as a Brave, even though he's still, what, like 25, 26? And it's basically been all downhill since he was, you know, pitching in the World Series. I'm going to use that as a strange transition to my first nugget, which is Mitch Haniger. Mitch Haniger, released by the Seattle Mariners, despite being owed $15 million in the final year of his contract. This is someone who, of course, having been acquired in one of Jerry DePoto's first big deals way back before, I guess it was 2016 or 2017, right before Thanksgiving. I'll never forget it. And he had a hell of a career with the Mariners. And then he left in free agency, went to the Giants. That didn't work out. They traded back for him thinking, oh, maybe this will work out to have him back. It didn't. He has been very injured in recent years and now just really does not fit on this roster to the point where it seems like they decided to move on. Mitch Haniger is one of the coolest Mariners that has existed during this run. And I think that he will always be remembered fondly. It is very unfortunate how this ended, but also I think that it's good that they recognize it instead of trying to continue to force it. So salute to you, Mitch Haniger. You were a hell of a Mariner and delivered some of the greatest moments during this run.
To another player who returned to a former team, the Orioles, they said our rotation isn't old enough. And they went out and they signed Kyle Gibson to join the staff. The Birds have been hit somewhat with injuries during camp to Grayson Rodriguez, and that's the main one. And so now they have Kyle Gibson around. I'm not exactly sure how much he'll throw. The rotation already has five dudes in it with Eflin, Morton, Kremer, Sugano, and Cade Povich.
Who do you think this is almost betting against? Like, I'm just trying to understand.
Povich or Sugano.
Yeah. Because Pope, right.
So, but the funny thing about betting against Sugano and your replacement is just like an older guy who throws even slower. I don't know. This is a weird
Sugano,
one.
Sugano, but it might end up St. Louis.
St. Louis Sugano. All right, Jordan, your turn.
All right. I'm going to go with the Tanner Bibee extension. The Guardians also busy. We'll probably talk about the trade that they made. But Tanner Bibee, who has just very quietly gone about his business as the Guardians rotation collapsed around him last year. He just kept on cooking. He has continued to do it this spring with a bunch of new faces around him on this pitching staff. And he gets a 5-year, $48 million deal. You could say, oh my God, that's cheap for Tanner Bibee. And then you look around and you say, well, it's look at pitchers. Pitchers. Who is also on the Guardians pitching staff who probably could have gotten a lot of money and then didn't? Shane Bieber, Tristan McKenzie, who's now in the bullpen. Like, imagine if he had signed an extension now, who knows if he's going to ever get to cash in. He loves it in Cleveland. I love talking to this dude. He is so steady, and this is a situation where you can imagine it just being a perfect match for both sides. And it's nice to see Cleveland investing again in its own players. And Bibee is someone that clearly they are going to be relying on for a while. I like the stat that I believe it was Kluber for five opening days in a row, and then Bieber for five opening days in a row, and now it could be Tanner Bibee for several opening days in a row.
I'll take Shane Bieber next year opening day. Speaking of pitchers, Shane McClanahan. There was a clip of McClanahan in a game throwing a pitch and immediately grabbing his arm. It looked really bad. Really, really bad. McClanahan, ace for the Rays, who missed all of last season coming back from Thomas Johnson. And we were like, no, 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 no. It was a big no, 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 God, please, prayer circle, etc. And we got relatively good news. It's just an inflamed nerve. What a weird world where that sentence makes sense. And he's not going to miss that much time. He is going to start the year in the IL. He's not going to start an opening day like he was supposed to. But look, a bullet dodged for now. Shane McClanahan, healthy-ish.
Yeah, and I'm not even going to say any more about Jared Jones other than I hope he doesn't need elbow surgery, but I am scared that he will. I'm not using that as one of my five because that is just going to make me sad. I want to talk about Christian Campbell making the Red Sox. Christian Campbell, It is official. He has made the opening day roster. His ascent is different than Cam Smith potentially making the open day roster, which is also amazing. But I just think about like a year ago, Christian Campbell was a sixth round pick or fourth round pick who had played 22 professional games and was like, oh, okay, whatever. Why is he important? And now he is the reason that Rafael Devers is moving to DH. Okay. Like, yes, Alex Bregman is also kind of the reason, but like Christian Campbell, them being so committed to having him be the opening day second baseman is really the reason why they are also going to have Bregman play third and seemingly Devers DH. That is an astonishing sequence of events. The fact that he is also the one to make the team and not Roman Anthony is amazing. And it is one of the more wild glow ups that we've seen in player development in quite some time. And I look forward to seeing if he is actually good. Christian Campbell.
I will take another player who made a team on the opposite end of the spectrum. Yuli Gurriel.
the Padres NRI squad. I think they had five NRIs make the roster.
Yuli Gurriel, who last year, do you know how many games he played in the regular season for the Royals?
In the majors?
In the major leagues for the Royals last year.
Like 30?
18. Okay, he spent basically the entire season in AAA with the Braves, latched on with the Royals down the stretch, hit sixth for them in October, and almost took Gerrit Cole deep at Yankee Stadium off the top of the wall. Okay, he is going to be, he's 41. This is his age 41 season. He's the oldest position player in baseball. He made the Padres as the, you should really be a grand Padre if you ask me.
I just, the Padres depth chart, and we talked about this, like this is kind of what's terrifying about them. The bottom of their roster is Gavin Sheets, Jason Hayward, Elias Diaz, that's like the bottom of the lineup, and then Maldonado, Gurriel, Jose Iglesias. I mean, like that right there, that whole, the fact that all of those guys made the team, that they brought them in, I don't know where Connor Joe is in this mix, I guess they signed him too. That is like what happened. Like AJ Preller traded away everything else, all the depth, all the Graham Paulies and, you know, Nathan Martorellas, all these other guys, they're gone. They are elsewhere. Jacob Marcy, right? Like he would have been competing for one of these spots. Anyway, so now you got a bunch of old guys. And maybe Gavin Sheets will hit 30 home runs now that he's not on the White Sox anymore. That is a great pick. I am going to go. Okay, we got to do it. Nolan Jones for Tyler Freeman. The Rockies continue to confound Nolan Jones, who, again, awesome rookie season 2023, injured, disappointing 2024. And what is most perplexing apparently to Rockies fans in particular is not just that they have given up on Nolan Jones. Tyler Freeman, he's fine. He'll be okay. He's going to play second while Tyro Estrada is injured. That's okay. He'll be a decent player. They have like 10 outfield prospects that the Rockies fans really want to see. Zach Veen, who won spring training MVP. That's apparently an award the Rockies give out to their own players.
Yet he did not make the team.
And he did not make the team. So it seemed like when this news came out, all the Rockies fans were like, well, this is super weird and probably bad, but at least we'll get to see these young guys. Oh, we'll see some Hunter Goodman, Jordan Beck, Zach Veen. They're like, no, actually, that's not who's going to be in the outfield. For some reason. It's Nick Martini who makes the team instead. Anyway, and then for Cleveland, like, man, like, if they can get Nolan Jones, that's a huge deal, because they are looking to replace some of that power lost by Josh Naylor. And if even he can do it in a platoon role, I like his chances to do it more than Will Brennan. And that's a pretty big addition here. So just an astonishing sequence of events. They get Nolan Jones back, and now him and Juan Brito can be friends.
With my last pick, I'll take something very disgusting. And that is Mookie Betts can't stop vomiting. He was scratched from Sunday's game. After the game, he was asked about it, and he basically said that he hasn't been able to keep down solid food for 2 weeks. We got some more clarity on when he started feeling bad. It was actually before they went to Tokyo, and he was sick on the plane. He is 150 pounds. There are some quotes in there where he's like, yeah, you know, it's hard to do your job when you don't eat food. And everyone is like,
I can imagine. I think what was most concerning is him being like, they haven't diagnosed it yet. Like, that is very weird. You would imagine that the Dodgers should have access to the best doctors around. And I know this is a unique situation for them to be dealing with a player, but I mean, I don't know, man. He said he was like, yeah, like, I feel fine. I just can't keep food down. Like, he says he's not like sick, which again is not good. It's not. And I'll play light. I'll play uphill. I'll try to work. I'm like, dude, okay. But I guess the question now is like, are the Dodgers going to let him if he's still, you know, puking every time he eats? I have no idea.
How many pounds does Mookie Betts have to lose and yet can still remain an impact ball player? We're about to find out. I would take 130-pound Mookie Betts over a lot of big leaguers, I'll tell you that much.
That's true. But we don't need him to lose any more weight. I mean, this is very... He said he started camp at like 175, and now he's down to 150, and that's not good. That's way too close to
Mookie
the highway. We don't like
eat.
That.
Literally, let Mookie eat.
Please.
Is this an episode of House?
I don't know. I just feel like the Dodgers should be able to find someone to diagnose something here so that we can start heading in the right direction for Mookie Betts. So I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical we're going to see him on Thursday, but against Tarek Skubal, hey, Mookie, you haven't eaten anything for 3 weeks. Here, go face Tarek Skubal.
Eat this.
Like, that seems like not the best idea, but, you know, wishing the best to Mookie and hope he can figure this out. My last topic is I'm just going to combine a couple Blue Jays things. Alejandro Kirk gets a $58 million extension. This is interesting to me because he has been seemingly trending the wrong way offensively the last couple of years, but is an elite framer, and most importantly, is really the only catcher that the Blue Jays have. And so this seems to be them. I've talked many times on this podcast. You got to know who your catcher is going to be no matter where you are in your competitive window. They believe in Alejandro Kirk. He's been great this spring, and he gets a nice hefty extension. And then the other Blue Jay who will be on the opening day roster that we were not necessarily expecting, although I am excited to see, is Mr. Allen Rodon, one of my favorite prospects in baseball, who has hit his way from being on the Creighton Blue Jays to the Toronto Blue Jays. And I'm just a big fan of this dude's game, and it's cool to see that they are not like, they're like, you know what, Allen Rodon, we're not going to manipulate your service time. We're not going to pretend like you need to work on your defense. Like, you're one of our best players right now. We have some injuries. Come on, come north with us and not just to Buffalo. Congratulations, Allen Rodon.
Congratulations, Allen Rodon, who is an astrophysics nerd and studied it in school, which is what my sister does. She's an astrophysics grad student. And I went up to Allen Rodon in spring training and was like, hey, I know what absorption light line spectroscopy is. And how about that? And he was like, you said that wrong. And I was like, I was close, though. And he was like, yeah. So there you go.
Doing my best.
Thank you to everybody who emailed us,
particularly
about the YOLO/Sacktown A's.
Got a ton of YOLO A's feedback. I got a bunch of people texting me about the YOLO A's. Mostly positive feedback about the YOLO A's. Maybe as the A's continue to become, you know, we'll have them playing in Sacramento soon. Like, Well, maybe we'll reference back some of these emails because I think they were very timeless. We appreciate the feedback there at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. And yeah, I guess opening days this week, Jake. That seems kind of fun.
Sick, dude. Thank you to Colin Brennan for producing. Thank you to Jordan Schusterman for podcasting. Thank you to Ellie De La Cruz for producing.
For producing on this podcast. We appreciate it. And we'll be back on Wednesday with more season preview content, including another special guest. Ooh, that'll be fun. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you on Wednesday. Bye.